that its sole purpose was to split the hip-hop audience in two, so that their sister station, the pop station Z100, could sit comfortably in the number one slot. So the idea was not for power to add to the vitality of hip-hop radio. Far from it. And we were prepared to fight. We were not completely blindsided when the announcement was made. A couple of months before, an internal email from Clear Channel had mistakenly ended up in the hands of Judy Ellis, our general manager. The email had outlined their plans to launch Power. And although we couldn't stop it, Judy sure as hell wasn't going to make it easy for them. She quickly bought the main URL address that listed Power 105.1 and linked them to Hot 97. Judy was such a G. Even today, if you go to www.power105.com, or www.power105.1.com, you will be greeted with the front page of the Hot 97 website. Pretty good. I wasn't necessarily afraid of competition, but Clear Channel's strategy infuriated me. The very notion that they valued their pop station more than their hip-hop station should have pissed people off. But no one seemed to care or notice. In my soul, I knew this was going to ruin hip-hop radio. We could no longer take the chances we used to. We could no longer break records from new hip-hop artists because the competition would be down the dial playing a hit. We had to play smarter. For a long time, we were able to keep them at bay because Power 105.1 had no history with the audience. They had no real hip-hop credibility. But then, that summer of 02, they found their opening as the Jay-Z-Nas battle began to take on epic proportions. Let me recap how this all happened. First, when I say battle or others say beef, those words don't even begin to capture one of the most highly publicized war of words in hip-hop history. It had been brewing for a while. As soon as Takeover started circulating, everyone was wondering if Nas was going to respond. At first, he didn't. Well, not for a few months. Nas's career had been kind of quiet at the time, and there were definitely people that had, at this point, begun to write him off. It had been 2 years since Nostradamus had come out, and the reception for that was mixed. Perhaps Takeover had finished him? Nope. The truth was, it did the opposite. It reignited him. The consensus was that it woke a sleeping giant. On December 4th, 2001, Flex debuted Nas's single, Ether, which Nas dropped strategically on Jay's birthday. He answered Takeover directly, and people went crazy. This was arguably one of the best diss records we'd ever heard. You a fan, a phony, a fake, a pussy, a stan. I still whip your ass. You 36 in a karate class. Feeling the pressure, I'm sure, Jay responded almost within a week with Super Ugly. It wasn't Ether. It wasn't even Takeover. It felt slapped together and people felt Jay crossed the line when he referenced having sex with the mother of Nas's daughter. I came in your Bentley back seat, skeeted in your Jeep, left condoms in the baby seat. The war of words became painful to hear. Jay and I, without a doubt, had become friends over the years. But I was also a Nas fan. Illmatic was one of my favorite albums of all time. And through the years, we had developed a great relationship. But now there was this war, and everybody wanted blood. When Flex debuted Super Ugly on the radio, he played it and Ether all night, back to back, over and over. The phone lines were going crazy. People were eating it up. Not only in New York, but we were getting calls from all over the country. At this point, Flex wanted to make sure that we made the most of this moment and that as a station, we owned it. We're going to bring Battle of the Beats back, Ange. We're going to let the city decide who wins this, and we're going to do it on your show tomorrow. My show? Why? Flex said my voice was one of authority, and the contest could start at night with his show and go into the day and end with me in the afternoons where I would announce the winner. The thought made me uncomfortable, but Flex convinced me that with Power looking to capture our audience, it was important to remind people that if it happens in hip-hop, it happens here. And he reminded me if we didn't do it, someone else would. So I agreed. Although I didn't know how the vote was going to go, you could feel the Nas wave building. In all this, Nas was being portrayed as the real MC, the underdog. What I've noticed in our culture is that everybody roots for the underdog, myself included. The only thing about the underdog theory that bothers me is for some reason we feel the need to knock somebody down, to build somebody else up. In general, this is something that has always irritated the shit out of me. It's such a terrible, dysfunctional way to treat anyone successful who comes from where we come from. I have always made it a point to not subscribe to that mentality. We should celebrate success and be inspired by it, even while we're championing someone new. But nobody wants to hear that shit when you're in the middle of a battle. We sat there and hand-counted the votes until the winner was clear. 60% of our listeners chose Ether over Super Ugly. As much as it irritated me to hear the venom toward Jay, I agreed that Ether was the better of the two records. I'm literally getting ready to announce the winner when I look into the hallway of the station and see Jay-Z walking into my studio. And the winner is Ether. I had to deliver Jay that blow while he was standing right there. To say he was uncomfortable is an understatement. I couldn't really figure out why he'd agreed to be interviewed in this moment. But evidently he had been under pressure. Like I said, a lot of people felt he had gone too far. Even his mother felt that way. She was the one who suggested that he apologize for getting a woman and a child involved by even mentioning them. I can see him sitting there like it was yesterday, defeated. I had never seen him like that before. He's somebody who's always been so big and confident, and I hated to see him down. This is a friend, and I was part of the machinery that brought him to this point. After the interview, we walked outside the studio to talk alone. "Yo," I said, "are we okay?" "Of course, I don't blame you for this," he said. "This was just something you kind of got sucked into, I'm clear. It's cool." I wasn't sure if it really was, but I hope so. The hype of that lasted for some time, and Jay took a much-needed vacation. By the time he came back, he was ready to talk again. He walked into the studio and announced, "Hovey's home." We had one of our most fun interviews that day. He had shaken it off. He was back. That was not the end of the drama, however. The competition between radio stations was about to kick into another gear. Power 105.1 began to get a little traction by going commercial-free for what seemed like months. They had the massive war chest of Clear Channel to fund their launch. But they still hadn't gained any real hip-hop credibility. In 2002, they finally found an opportunity. Nas was slated to perform at Hot 97 Summer Jam and had something planned for Jay. Still fueled by winning the battle, he was planning to hang a Jay-Z look-alike doll from a noose on stage while he performed. Our program director was like, "No fucking way. We're not hanging anyone in effigy on our stage." She didn't say he couldn't diss Jay, but she just didn't want a noose on the Summer Jam stage. Nas got pissed and didn't show up to perform. We were all there waiting for him to close the show when people started calling us to say he's on Power 105.1 instead, talking shit about everybody at Hot, me included. It was supposed to be Hot 97's biggest night of the year, but all you could hear in the Summer Jam parking lot was everyone in their cars listening to Nas on Power 105.1. This was not good. That same night, I must have been on the phone with Flex for like 3 hours. What the fuck was this guy thinking? This is after the battle, after you played the shit out of his record, and I did everything I could to be fair. Nas won the fucking battle. What is his problem? Apparently, Nas felt like the station in general was loyal to Jay and didn't allow him to express himself the way he deemed to be appropriate. Hanging a noose around Jay-Z's neck in front of 60,000 people was the expression in question. Not only did Nas go after Hot 97, but the Power interview was a disgruntled ex-employee of ours, egging him on. And Nas willingly took the bait. "I'm letting people know why I'm not at Summer Jam. I've been bamboozled, hoodwinked, and the whole time I was told and begged to do the Summer Jam. I was begged to come to Hot 97 because I had a hot new record that nobody wanted to support except for the streets. I was told to come there and save Edgy Martinez's job. I was told to come there and help the ratings at Hot 97 by Flex and the rest of the crew over there. I'm here to let my people know, all of my hip-hop community people know that I was dissed this morning by Hot 97 and told what I couldn't do on the show. It's really outrageous and it really shows the wrong people are in power. This hip-hop thing comes from the streets. We need our freedom." It went on. I never actually listened to the whole interview, but I heard enough to know that he was mocking the music I was making, questioning my credibility, and accusing me of being unfair. At the same time, Nas also gave validity to the competitive radio station. It was a 1-2 punch. Like I said, these were noisy times. That's something that's been a constant in my career, my life, that I've always had to be aware of, that noise is just noise, good or bad. I just had to know that this was one of those times and it would pass. In these moments, I always try to get quiet, and stay focused on whatever matters the most in the long run. If I have a great interview and everybody's telling me, wow, that's amazing, you're the shit, I try to hold that middle line. That's really nice, thank you. But really, it's just noise. They're just excited about this one moment. It doesn't mean I'm straight in 5 years. It means I had a moment that's noisy in a good way. And when it's bad, that doesn't mean you don't feel the sting, but you feel it and then move through it. It's a tough lesson, but a powerful one. And fortunately for me, I was able to tune things out and be gracious about it. Because I knew ultimately that Flex was going to get on the radio and handle this as only he could. And he did. Not that I agreed with everything he said all the time. But when Flex went to war on the radio, it gave me the opportunity to take the high road. To not have to defend shit. It's like having a big brother who will do it for you. That's what Flex was for me. Getting quiet and falling back was not my way of not having any feelings at all. No, I hated that Nas did that. I was disappointed that he had made it personal. I would have thought we were cool enough that if he had a problem, he would come to me first, as opposed to getting on the radio and talking shit about me. I would never do that to you. Why the fuck would you do that to me? Yeah, even as I detached, I was annoyed for some time. Then I got calls from magazines like XXL and The Source. My statement was simple. Listen, I wish the best for Nas, but you know, I wish he would have come to me. There was still blood in the water. People had taken sides across the industry, record reps, artists, managers, everyone. None of that really bothered me. But what did hurt was that Salaam was standing so close to Nas. He had produced songs on Stillmatic, the album Ether was on. And through the whole ordeal, he had never reached out to me to see if I was okay. Nas tried to shut my lights out, and to not hear from Salaam was like being left for dead. We'd reconnect in the future, but for the time being, I was disappointed. Finally, Tracy Cloherty, holding the reins as program director, and Steve Stout, who was managing Nas then, came to an agreement that, okay, we're going to get him on the radio. Nas is going to come to Hot 97 so that he can squash this publicly, Stout told Tracy. Nas is going to come up and apologize. So Tracy calls me into her office and says, listen, we're going to have Nas come up to be on your show. Fuck Nas. No, he's going to apologize. Well, he better apologize, I say. Well, then Nas got there and I could tell he wasn't informed about the apologize memo. So now we're on the radio and we're like two little mad kids with their arms crossed. I'm cocky with my arms folded like, well? And he's like, well? Because in his mind, he clearly felt something along the lines of, shit, I don't got nothing to apologize for. Somehow we got through the interview. Nas admitted he had read one of my statements and thought, yeah, you were right. I could have just come to you. I asked that moving forward he would. He agreed. Toward the end, we both lightened up. I think we were both aware that since we had agreed to be there, that neither one of us wanted to be in a bad place with each other. He was like, all right already, Ange. And we just kind of laughed it off and the topic slid off the table. The following time I saw him, I mentioned it again. Are you ever going to let it go? Nas asked. All right, fine, I'll let it go. We've had amazing conversations since then, on and off air. I don't think he's ever officially apologized, and I sure as fuck haven't. But just the fact that we were able to laugh at it after is enough for me. I probably did things in his eyes that I should have apologized for too. But we both had enough respect for each other to just keep it pushing. And yes, it's true, my relationship with Nas was not my relationship with Jay. But it doesn't take away from the fact that I adore Nas. And more important, I respect Nas. And the good news was that we all pushed past it. The PS part of the story is that just as the smoke was clearing, Power 105.1 was getting legs. Nas's rant gave them a credibility they'd never had before. And now Hot became what Jay was in the battle we just ended. Now we're the ones to dethrone. And the hate begins. Now we have to work harder. That was the beginning. Much as I hate to say it as a current radio personality, it really hurt New York radio for good. Before, we had this hip-hop station that was free to do what we wanted to do. And that was the beauty of it. But as we had feared, the other station made it such that the goals changed. We now operated in a different way. It was the only way to survive. I remember the reality hitting me and wondering, don't people see it? Don't they realize that station is going to kill everything? The new rules would have to become, oh, my interview has to be 2 minutes long because if we go too long, they're going to change the dial and we're going to lose the ratings. So the interviews were shortened. This is what happens. It changes everything. It becomes about business. I mourned. But this was the world we lived in. And to have longevity, I had to relearn radio. Oh, you want my breaks to be 30 seconds long? What? I used to talk for 8 minutes. How do I do that? At the same time, other changes required getting aggressive with social media because now people had other ways to get their info and music. My way of making it work was to see this as an opportunity to engage my listeners in a different way, trying to focus my energy into forward motion as opposed to being stuck in what was gone. Yes, you can mourn things when they're gone, but also you ultimately have to embrace change. Keep trying to use the things that you learned and implement them in new ways. Maybe the bottom line is that you have to be honest about the times. In moments when I was nervous or insecure or uncertain, Flex was always confident, always reassuring me, we got this. Don't worry, Ange. We're going to figure this out. Flex always wanted to win, even before I knew it was important. He always had that thing. So as things changed, he was ready for it. We're going to win, he assured me. Okay, I said, and tried my best to believe him. Chapter 12, Family Affair. Besides everything that had happened on radio in 2002, I had been pushing hard as an artist while promoting my second album, Animal House. The first single, If I Could Go, featuring Sicario and Little Mo, was a legitimate hit. Not only was it top 10 on urban radio, but it flew up the pop charts too. The album debuted at number 11 on the Billboard chart. After that, I scored a more modest hit with Take You Home, featuring Khalees. When it came time to take stock of how far I could go or wanted to go as an artist beyond the radio mic, I had to face some complicated feelings. I'd worked really hard to create these two albums, which gave me a whole new respect for the artists who were great at what they do. And not just because they work hard to master their art, but because they have to put themselves out there to be judged by everybody and anybody. The criticism I got was to be expected on one hand, but still, people were really critical. If a song didn't do well, then it was keep your day job. When some of the releases did really well, I got hammered for being too commercial. The truth is, as hard as people were on me, I was even harder on myself. I wasn't confident enough to know if I'd ever deliver to my own standards. In hindsight, I wish I'd done a better job of not letting the outside negativity affect my goals as a recording artist. I wish I could have given myself the same encouragement I'd offer to anyone else in my shoes. Even if I wasn't that great yet, maybe I could have grown and gotten better if I had kept at it. But at that particular crossroads, I didn't believe I could ever rise to the level of what I could accomplish on air. So while I was considering my future as an artist, I didn't want to miss any opportunities to build my career. That's what I had been saying to Pekas, pressuring him to step it up on my behalf. I thought he should be doing more, so I kept on him. What are you bringing in? What's next? So I'm sure he was happy when American Idol called to meet with me. The show had debuted the year before, and it was a huge ratings hit. After that, I had a couple of meetings with Fox, and eventually they offered me the job as the fourth judge, joining the panel with Simon Cowell, Paula Abdul, and Randy Jackson. The craziest part of this was that I had never seen the show. Promoting the album that year, I'd been traveling so much, who had time to watch TV? It happened so fast. It was all in about two meetings. And then they waved me on in. Okay, come on. We began with the first rounds of auditions on the road. I believe the first cities were Detroit and Chicago. I was excited that our next stop was going to be New York. The production spared no expense flying us out and putting us up. So I was feeling pretty good about everything as I arrived at the convention space where auditions were held. I saw the other judges, Paula, Simon, and Randy, with their big entourages of hairstylists, makeup artists, and assistants. Then I go into the hair and makeup to find they have no one assigned to me. Excuse me? This is a network television show and there's a hair person who doesn't even have a blow dryer or a flat iron. It's a girl with a comb. So clearly I'm the stepchild. Nobody ever sat me down and told me what the audition or even filming process would be like or how I could contribute. They just threw me in. All of a sudden I'm taking on this coveted role and not feeling the love and definitely not feeling cute. From the beginning, the energy was weird. Later, it became apparent that the network had wanted to hire me, but that the production company did not want another judge. So I somehow got tossed in the middle of all that. There was another reason I felt not up to par that had nothing to do with not having a hair and makeup person. The truth was, I had just figured out I was pregnant and hadn't told anyone about it yet. Like nobody. I had just started dating someone new and literally found myself pregnant 3 months into the relationship. Nauseous and emotional, I was starting to put on weight and couldn't do much but put on a velour juicy sweatsuit and try to cover it up. I called Dame Dash, who had a clothing line with his then girlfriend Rachel Roy, and of course, Rockaware, the clothing line he started with partner Jay-Z, and he sent 4 big boxes of clothes right away. Since the days of him and Jay pushing records out of the back of their Benz, Dame had always been supportive of me and my career. He's a polarizing guy. Either you love him or hate him. But there's no question that he's a visionary who had great ideas and took on execution of projects in his own unique way. He did all these Rockefeller movies that would later become classics, and he put me in a bunch, like Paper Soldiers, Paid in Full, and State Property 2. The experience opened my eyes to possibilities of acting and trying things beyond radio. So at this point, I valued his opinion. He was always somebody I felt was looking out for me. And now in this moment of utter uncertainty on the set of American Idol, I soaked up his advice about how to handle the situation. Dame reminded me how to stay sane and not get lost in the big Hollywood setting. Keep your real friends around, he said, because your life is going to change fast. And if you were surrounded by a bunch of new people, corny people, Hollywood types, that's how people lose themselves. Stay sane. Keep your crew around. Find jobs for them if you need to. I kept that in mind as I sat there surrounded by new people, trying to be fair in my role as fourth judge. The weirdness of what I was doing there, Dame's advice, my raging prenatal emotions, my empathy for the artists putting their dreams on the chopping block, it was a lot to process. I tried to focus on the talent. I gave enthusiastic feedback, but that was not at all what they demanded. In fact, the show's producer, Nigel Lithgow, kept running over to me at the judges' table and scolding me. You can't like everybody. He kept pushing me to be harder, be harsher. I felt the pressure. As I was assessing the process, it bothered me to watch the production people send in mediocre or bad singers on purpose. Outside the doors, the team would fill them up with hope about how great they were, only to send them in for us to crush them. And being crushed seems funny on TV, but when you're watching it in front of you, from 12 feet away, not so much. I'll especially never forget this Dominican girl from New York who sang Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You. She did miss a couple of notes, but for the most part, she was great. It could have been nerves that made her miss those notes, but after being told that I couldn't always like everybody, when it came time for me to give her a yay or nay, I said no to sending her to Hollywood. That was hard enough. But before she left the room, as she stood there looking so crushed, she looked right at me and said, "You know, Angie, out of everybody, I thought you would have been the one to support me." It broke my heart. That was the moment when I had to face what had just happened. Wow. I did something that was against who I was. I let the powers that be make me treat somebody in a way that I didn't want to treat her. I wanted to support her. I wanted to help her. I wanted to encourage her. She was good. And I let this TV exec make me go there. I hated it. Maybe I was more emotional than usual because of the pregnancy, but the notion did occur to me. What if one of these kids gives up their dream? Or even worse, even darker, I thought, what if one of these kids kills themselves? When you're being asked to shit on people over and over, humiliating them for entertainment, this moment of paranoia doesn't seem that far-fetched. On my fourth day of being on the road with the show, I'm in my dressing room and Nigel comes in and very carefully in his proper British accent says, "Well, he doesn't know if this, me, is working." "It's not," I say. "It's not working." I don't know if he's about to fire me or not, but I am honest enough to say it's not working. "You hate it," he says. "Yes, I hate it." In that moment, I knew I had to leave. And the best thing for everybody concerned was to just bow out. Nigel looked relieved. Obviously, he could now go to the network and say, "Well, she doesn't want to do it anymore." And then they would win. Without any reservation, I quit. The next couple of weeks were a publicity frenzy. After all, we had just made the big announcement that I was on the show, and now it was over and time to explain. The thing was, I wasn't sure what had happened. I hadn't had a chance to process it, let alone put it into words. Besides being swollen and nauseous, I was also sort of foggy about everything. But this was a big deal, and the news did what the news does, like the MTV news piece on October 31st, 2002. That said, a week after signing on to be a judge on the second season of American Idol, New York DJ hip-hop artist Angie Martinez has bailed on the show, citing her discomfort with squashing the hopes of would-be Kelly Clarkson's. After that, Diane Sawyer interviewed me on Good Morning America. And just before we went on air, she told me that Charlie Gibson thought I was a hero. Evidently, he wasn't a fan of how some of the kids were being treated either. Diane added, "I think it shows great character." In that moment of vulnerability, her gesture of support and understanding made me feel so much more comfortable and confident in my decision. Sitting across from her, I felt like I was exactly where I was supposed to be. After that interview, I really put the episode to bed. Ultimately, the opportunity of American Idol just wasn't for me. And it's funny because later I would watch Jennifer Lopez do it, and she's so good at it. Plus, she was able to be kind, yet also real. But Jennifer is somebody who has walked that walk. She has done those auditions. She knows. That wasn't my background at all. So I felt like a fraud sitting there looking at these kids and thinking, how can I tell you what note you should be hitting when I haven't hit a note in my damn life? Actually, the highlight of the entire experience came at the very end, right after deciding that I wasn't going to continue with the show. Instead of going back to my apartment, I went back to the suite at the Four Seasons in Manhattan. That was one thing about American Idol that I would miss. They fly you first class and they put you in suites at the Four Seasons with VIP perks everywhere you go. What now? I didn't know who to call or what to do with myself, so I just called the girls, Nikki, Liani, and Tracy, and they came over. They're always there for me when I need them most. We ordered room service on American Idol. Tracy was like, screw it, they're paying, right? We need to order some shit. We did. They ordered mimosas, mad drinks, and so much food. We analyzed what the next few days would be like and together put some strategies in place and toasted to true friendship. Like a blip that dissolved in time, the 4 days on Idol were soon behind me. My new job was trying to get used to being pregnant, which I never quite figured out. My whole pregnancy was horrible. Oh, it was horrible. People say they have morning sickness. I had all day sickness for 6 months. I would be on the radio, do a talk break, and run to the bathroom to throw up. I had to go to the doctor because I started coughing up blood. I was throwing up so much that I started getting tears in the lining of my throat. Yeah, it was bad. Around month 6, the nausea tapered off a little bit. You would think that with all that nausea, I would have lost weight. But all I craved and all I ate were carbs. So it was biscuits for breakfast and mashed potatoes for lunch. By the end of my pregnancy, I gained nearly 70 pounds. My ankles looked like my thighs, literally, like two tree trunks. For the last 3 months, I could barely walk. On the last day of work before my maternity leave, Mariah Carey surprised me with a baby shower on the radio. Mariah is a New Yorker and a hip-hop fan, so over the years, she'd become friendly with a bunch of us at the station. And no one is more festive than Mariah. Oh my God, it was so sweet. The whole staff was there. There was cake, balloons, champagne, a huge poster of a baby that everyone signed. All sorts of gifts, like a rosary from Jacob the Jeweler, a car seat from Mr. C, Burberry baby robes. To this day, people I meet in the streets always say, I remember you had your baby shower on the radio. It was so personal, which I don't usually do. My mom called into the show and put into words exactly what I was feeling when she said, my heart is getting ready to explode. Shortly after finding out I was pregnant, I moved in with Tamir, the father of the baby I was about to have, in his house in New Jersey, which I decided to spend my album money fixing up. The nesting had begun. A lot of complicated issues came up the closer I got to my due date. Of course, I wanted my child to grow up with the benefit of two parents being there, something I'd never had. But this guy and I barely knew each other before conceiving a baby. Plus, I hadn't grown up with an example of what a good father or husband was. I honestly didn't know if this was the man I was meant to be with forever. But when I saw what a committed father he was to Jordan, his 3-year-old son from a former relationship, I had faith that he would be a good dad to our child. That was the one thing I wanted to get right. The only thing I did know, because I just knew this was a blessing from God, was that I would try to do all I could to create that family setting. June came around, and this was the first summer jam that I was ever going to miss. The station sent a camera crew to my house so I could welcome the crowd on the big screen. In the video, I looked like four of me. When you're pregnant, you're supposed to have a belly. I was like a full house. You know I wasn't in my right mind if I agreed to let them film me like that. But I hated not being there and kept getting everyone to give me reports. Patty Duke told me DJ Mr. C was overwhelmed by the enormity of the show and said, I wish Ange was here to see how far we've come. Mr. C had been in hip-hop for a long time. DJing for Big Daddy Kane in the 80s, discovering B.I.G. in the 90s, and now like our own personal mayor at Hot 97. He cared about the culture and the station as much as any of us, and was moved by the massive number of people in attendance. This was the year that Summer Jam moved from Nassau Coliseum on Long Island to the Giant Stadium football arena, with 60,000 people in attendance. It was bigger than ever. Eminem stole the show that year, dissing The Source and smashing on stage the Lyricist of the Year trophy the magazine had awarded him. In the meantime, back at the station, Sonny Anderson had been filling my time slot. I'm sure Sonny wondered if I was ever going to come back. As it happened, my time off was more than a maternity leave. Actually, they never really paid me for my maternity leave. Technically, my contract was up, and I was in no rush to sign another one. My explanation was I needed time to figure things out. Not only was I moving into a new house and having a baby, but I hadn't taken a break since I was 18 years old and desperately needed one. Other than becoming a mother, I didn't have the bandwidth to consider what the next phase of my life or career would be. For the first time in a long, long time, I wasn't going to keep pushing to the next opportunity. I was going to experience this rite of passage to a different life and all that it entailed. As motherhood inched closer, my OBGYN kept waving off my insistence that I knew my own body. Throughout the pregnancy, I'd been telling her, listen, all the women in my family have C-sections. I don't know if it's a curse. We don't dilate. My mother had one, my grandmother, my aunts. Just schedule me a C-section, I said. No, you have to try natural labor, she encouraged. You'll heal so much faster. Okay, lady. During the last month of pregnancy, they did a test that told me that if I didn't get the baby out soon, it would be 10 pounds. Dr. Marks decided, we're going to induce you on June 11th. On June 11th, 2003, I arrived at the hospital at 4 a.m. or 6 a.m. or some ungodly hour and went through 26 hours of labor. So terrible. Three epidurals. Why? Because the first two didn't work. I have a huge needle in my back and it isn't working. I'm screaming, try again. Put it in again. I needed them to keep trying because the contractions felt like they were going to kill me. Finally, the third epidural kicks in. A few hours later, they tell me that I'm not dilating enough and that I'm going to have a C-section. All of that labor for no reason. Then I go have a C-section and they give me morphine for the pain. Well, it turns out that I have some sort of allergy to morphine. So I break out into hives. I'm scratching everywhere. Could it get any worse? No. Instead, everything becomes perfect. Because in that next moment, I'm holding my son for the first time and he is amazing and worth every moment and more. Nico Tamir Ruffin, 8 pounds, 9 ounces, a hefty baby. I was so high from the morphine. The first thing I'm told I said to my son was, you're not going to bring any dirty girls to mommy's house, right? By choice, that wouldn't have been the first thing I should have said to him. As part of a larger conversation, maybe. At this point, I just wanted a healthy baby. That's really all that mattered. Then I held him in my arms and fell in love. And I realized my life was changed forever. The thing that people rarely tell you is having a baby is a big fucking deal. Sure, people do it all the time. So the attitude tends to be, oh, it's just a baby. No, it's a big deal. The media makes it look like she bounced back in 2 weeks and she's a size zero. She's back at work 3 days after having a baby. You see all these new moms out brunching. Those women are aliens. I always tell my friends who are new moms, don't compare yourself to the aliens. God bless them. They inspire me. But for most women, it does not work like that. And for me, it didn't. Reality is that you feel like shit. Your body is different. Your life is different. It's amazing and phenomenal and overwhelming and emotional, but it's a legitimate change and by no means a small one. I had a baby and everything stopped. I felt all types of shit that nobody had prepared me for. When Nico was a newborn, at least four times a night, I would go to his crib and put my hand over his chest to make sure I was moving. Is he okay? I rested my face gently next to him to make sure he was still breathing. I was paranoid. I was terrified. There was this constant worry. One evening when Nico was about a month old, I was in the kitchen making a whole wheat English muffin with a piece of turkey bacon. That was my diet as I started trying to lose my baby weight. I was sleep deprived, completely exhausted from being up all night breastfeeding. Suddenly, I stopped breathing for a couple of seconds. I had this feeling like, okay, when is this part going to be over? When am I going to stop being worried? And then I had this moment. Holy shit, I realized. Never. Anger swelled inside of me. Well, why the fuck did nobody ever tell me that? Nobody tells you that. Nobody prepares you for that. A terrifying feeling sank in. As a mother, now I have to worry about somebody forever. For the rest of my life. I didn't even think about that ahead of time. My son's nursery was my version of what I thought a Pottery Barn pamphlet should look like. I bought all the things you're supposed to buy. The crib, the mobile, the changing table that I never used because I always changed him on the bed. And then he wound up sleeping in the little bassinet next to my bed. Since I was breastfeeding him every 2 or 3 hours, a lot of times he would just be lying in the bed with me, even though they say that's not safe. I was always half awake anyway, so he was fine. But after being sleep deprived for 3 months, it started making me nuts. I thought I was going to die. 2 hours of sleep here, 1 hour here, 2 hours tonight, 3 hours tomorrow. It was making me nuts. I'm living in this secluded cul-de-sac in Westwood, New Jersey. It's beautiful, but I'm in this big house in this neighborhood that I don't know. And I just had a baby with somebody that I barely knew. I haven't even known him for a year. It was a weird time. There I am, sitting in the living room in my chair, facing the TV. The TV's on, but I'm not watching it. I'm going through the Rolodex in my brain to think if I can remember ever hearing about anybody who died from exhaustion. This was a serious thought. I wasn't being funny. The notion taunted me. Wait, can people die from this? Have I known anyone who's passed away from sleep deprivation? Am I going to die? In the moment, I was really trying to figure this out. Could I die from being so tired? My son's father almost didn't factor in such a weird way. At one point, I began to wonder, is this guy going to do more? How does this work? Is he supposed to share more of this worry and responsibility? You don't want them to do more because they're never going to do it right or the way you want it done, my girlfriend Yvette advised me. So you should just do it yourself. You are so right, I agreed. It was such great advice. Let me just handle this. This is not to say that Tamir didn't do anything, but in my own little world, he just didn't really play in. I mean, he was there, but the mother, the breastfeeder, you are the one. The guy will be sleeping and you're up 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 5 in the morning, 7 in the morning. At this point, I was doing what I had to for Nico and myself. My son was 3 months old when I started getting calls from management at HOT asking, hey, you coming back to work? Work? I'm still trying to motivate myself to change out of these gray sweats and brush my hair. I was more tired than ever, trying to adjust to being a mother, to living with somebody in a new place. In every way, I felt disconnected from myself. While I could relate to those women who say, I couldn't wait to get back to work. A part of me was not pressed to go back to that set of demands. But I was still trying to clear my mommy brain and needed something to snap me out of it. It wasn't like I was financially set to not work. At some point, I had to go back. But in that period, I wasn't ready. So I ignored all the calls from the station. It was Flex who drove out to my house to bring me back to work. I don't know if the station sent him or if it was his idea. He hid his shock at finding me in this hole, deep in Jersey, removed from everything. My roots with my earlobes. This was before Ombre was cool. As I sat there in my gray sweats every day. You gotta come back, Ange, Flex said, trying to convince me. There's a new general manager there. Judy Ellis had resigned and Barry Mayo had been brought in to replace her. Flex said, You should go in and tell Barry how you feel about being underpaid. I think at this point they'd be willing to make a change there. He hit a nerve. On a primal level, I knew that I still loved my job. But I was stuck. I had to get past the exhaustion before I could restart the engines. I had been working so hard for so long. Sometimes you've got to shut down. I just need a minute, I explained. Nico was almost 4 months old when I got a call about being a guest host on The View. I was still in that cloudy state in a daze. I still had my baby weight and felt swollen and gross. I didn't think it was the right fit for me, but it was an opportunity to be on a really successful show. That was some of the old me coming back to life, telling myself, no matter how you're feeling, you get up and you show up. Of course you have to go. I arrived at The View studio on the west side of Midtown Manhattan and was shocked. I looked around like, oh, the world is still happening. People are still doing this. Everybody's still working? It was the Twilight Zone. During the show, I barely said anything. I didn't feel connected to anything that they were talking about. I mean, I'm okay with going outside of my comfort zone. I'm just not into putting a square peg into a round hole. The cast at the time was Barbara Walters, Joy Behar, Meredith Vieira, Elizabeth Hasselbeck, Star Jones, and that group. Those women, they talk fast. You have to be aggressive. Get in there. Get your points out. They don't wait for you to say your opinion. It was intense and did not feel particularly inviting or warm. I was in my oversized black jacket trying to cover my post-baby weight. I sat there feeling bloated and just wanted to get home to my kid. Ironically, The View appearance did plant seeds in my mind for one day having a TV show of my own that was more like the vibe I like to have with guests on the radio. It wasn't a total loss as far as opportunities go. And I've actually been back on several times since then, and the experience was much better. That was a lesson I was just starting to understand. How everything leads to something, and that even the losses can become material to grow from later. Still, at that point in time, I had this feeling of navigating with an outdated map. This whole period felt weird and foggy. Wasn't I doing what women were supposed to do? That was the map. I'm supposed to meet somebody. We're going to have a baby. We're going to get a big house. I redid the house. I was cooking all the time. All of a sudden, I was transforming into this domestic person because I thought that was what my life was supposed to be now. And it was uncomfortable for me. Reality check. Okay, well, what's real here? What's happening? I started contemplating. What is inspiring me? Then I realized, oh, nothing. Not that I don't like to cook or that I don't like to be around my family. I do. But I was doing it in a way that was not authentic or organic. The wheels started to turn. What map had I been using for my career? It was probably the one that said, even if I wasn't making what I should have, and I was way, way underpaid for quite some time, I was still just grateful to be there. I loved what I did. I liked making money, but I wasn't pressed to make more. Maybe I felt like I didn't deserve it. My mother once told me that everybody is replaceable. She told me about radio personalities who were the hot shit, and then if they left, somebody else replaced them. I always felt replaceable. So I never wanted to make too much money because I always thought that would mean I would be the first person that would be looked at like, well, is she worth it? I still think that to an extent. I do know my value, but I try never to get too comfortable or take anything at all for granted. Then again, after all those years when I never really pushed for a raise, that began to change once I became a mother. Now I had a kid. I had a house. Maybe it was time to say, okay, I think I paid my dues already. It's time to pay me what I'm worth. I knew I wanted more. As Flex had suggested, I finally set up a meeting with Barry, the new general manager at the station. When I arrived, bypassing all the familiar faces, I took a deep breath and walked into Barry's office. For the first time, I just asked for it, what I thought I was worth. It was much easier asking him than it would have been if Judy were still in that chair. I had so much loyalty to Judy and felt so indebted to her for giving me my career that a conversation about what I was worth would have had to come from a more humble place. Barry and I had no history, which in this case was good. You're right. You deserve more, Barry said. I think he was probably surprised at how little I was making. Bottom line, they wanted me back, and they doubled my salary. Cut to Friday, October 29th, 2004. The parking garage of Madison Square Garden, where I was waiting in a long line to get my car after seeing one of the most amazing and bizarre concerts of my life. Just then, I got a call from Mike Kaiser of Def Jam. "Yo, where you at?" Mike asks. "Just left the building," I say. "It's late and I have to get on the road. But Mike has an interview that needs to happen right away." It had been about a month since I'd been back on the air, but I still wasn't feeling completely like myself. But that moment when I first took my seat at the Garden that Friday night for the first of three nights that were part of the Best of Both Worlds tour with Jay-Z and R. Kelly, I became a fan all over again and got swept up in the anticipation of an amazing performance from both of them. And when they came out together to open the show, both of them dressed in white, the Garden went bananas. Then they started taking turns doing solo sets. First Jay, then R. Kelly, and then Jay. I was on my feet, singing or rapping along, rocking out with everybody in the audience. Then all of a sudden, when it was time for R. Kelly to take his next turn, instead of performing, he stood there on stage and talked to everyone about something that had just happened backstage and why he couldn't continue with the concert. He had said that two people had come at him, waving guns. He was genuinely freaked out and was holding back tears. "I can't do no show like that." And then he told everyone it was over as he dropped the mic and left the stage. Everyone in the house was saying and thinking the same thing. What the fuck? What guns? What people? We all sat there in shock and rising anger until Jay decided to take over and do the show old school on his own, improvising with planned and surprise guests and whoever was in the house. Mary was there and was a showstopper. Pat Goss, who was working at Arista at the time, was sitting with Usher, who was signed to the label then, and suddenly heard from Jay that they wanted Usher to come up and do some songs. Pekas wound up DJing for Usher. No, Pekas is not a DJ, but somehow he pulled it off. All of these moments were improvised and spontaneous. It was amazing to see everybody do their best to have Jay's back. T.I. was there and performed. There was Memphis Bleek, Foxy Brown, Freeway, and the Young Guns. Ja Rule came out and did Can I Get A with Jay, and it just blew the roof off. I couldn't begin to say what my favorite song was, but when Jay asked, "New York, y'all got me?" and then did Where I'm From and Heart of the City, I felt that shit. In that moment, I started to feel connected again. I was a hip-hop fan, on my feet, along with everyone in the building. Whatever had really happened to R. Kelly backstage was clearly a story yet to be told. But I'd never seen anything like this. For all the love that New York showed Hov that night, and he gave back, there were some diehard R. Kelly fans who were pissed. People were threatening to sue for their money back and burn all their R. Kelly CDs. As I was about to hear, in addition to the two people with guns, R. Kelly would claim that Tata, Jay's longtime friend, had pepper sprayed him and members of his entourage backstage. He couldn't perform at that point because he had to be taken to the hospital. But none of this was known when I went to get my car at the parking garage and got the call from Mike Kaiser. Before I could say anything, Kaiser explained, "Jay-Z wants to come see you tonight. He wants to go on the radio now. This isn't even my time slot. And she doesn't want to talk to anybody but you." Okay, let me call Tracy. Walking along, I've got the station on the phone and I begin to spread the word to some of my fellow concert goers who are ahead of me in line, explaining why I have to get my car fast and drive to the station. When the people ahead of me flash dirty looks as I jumped ahead of them, I say, "I'm really sorry to cut the line, but Jay-Z wants to come up to the radio." Everyone is instantly caught up in the excitement and drama. "What? Oh, shit. Go. Let her go to the front of the line. Yo, let Angie go. She's about to interview Jay." As the crowd parted, I got the car and rushed to the station, bumping the on-air host, and am in position when Jay comes up. He's telling me the whole story of the tour and how frustrated he is. Jay's not somebody who just talks the talk. He's not going to over-explain anything or overshare unnecessarily. But that late night, early morning, whoa, he has some shit to say. Jay-Z. "First of all, Angie, you know I'm not a catty dude. I'm not here to be catty." Angie. "Right." Jay-Z. "But you know, you can't put me out there like that. You know what I'm saying? Like there's people that had their tickets a month, 2 months. And you know what I'm saying? And they ready to see a show. They don't see a show. So, we having problems on the tour. I'm holding this kid down like, you know, he's having problems with life. He's not having problems with life. He's having a problem with with the reaction that people give me. The love that people give me is hurting this guy's heart. He's insecure with himself. Angie. Wow. Jay-Z. You know what I'm saying? So, Angie, this is not the first time this happened, right? Jay-Z. No, this is the fifth time. Maybe because I have a relationship with him, I believed everything he told me about what happened that night. But there's always two sides to the story though, right? In the middle of talking with Jay, my program director, Tracy, called. Is everything okay up there? Is he on? Yeah, everything's good. Don't worry. Well, I just got word from R. Kelly's people that he wants to come up too. Unbelievable. On air, I told Jay, just so you know, R. Kelly wants to come by. All right, cool. We're almost done anyway, he said. We continued. Angie, obviously you don't want to talk to R. Kelly right now. Jay-Z, you could talk to him and I'll leave the building. Y'all could have a great conversation. Angie, okay. Jay-Z, you know, when he wants to talk to me, tell him, man, look me in my face and talk to me. Angie, okay. The likeliness of the tour continuing is very laughter. I'm sure not good. Jay-Z, I'm going. You can do whatever you want. It's your radio station again. Thanks a lot. New York, I love you. I swear. Jay left and 20 minutes later, R. Kelly came walking in. It must have been about 2:30 a.m. and I was on the radio with R. Kelly, whose eyes were still red from pepper spray. He had glasses on, but you could tell something had happened. R. Kelly I'd only met a couple of times and I didn't know him well. But as always, everybody that comes in the door is clean. I'm going to give you your side now. I pride myself on trying to be fair, always. When I asked if he had a problem with jealousy or ego when it came to Jay, R. Kelly shrugged it off, saying, I love performing. I'm very secure with who I am. I have no motive, no reason to be jealous of Jay-Z. I'm a fan of Jay-Z. I'm going to always be a fan of Jay. Tonight had nothing to do with Jay getting the better response. I'm 15 years deep in the game. I know what Jay is at home. I expected Jay to rip down the garden. So the deal with the guns, he said, was that he had received a threatening phone call prior to arriving at the garden. And he said that during his first joint set with Jay, a man a few rows from the stage gave him a threatening gesture. Dude opened his coat. I can't say dude had a gun. I don't know what I saw. But a little later, he saw somebody else making a gesture like he was holding a gun. And because his family was backstage, R. Kelly said he became so upset that he panicked. At that point, he was not going to continue because I wasn't going to take any chances when I saw what I saw. I'm not crazy. Well, then, he went on to say, one of the promoters sent out more security and convinced him to get back on stage. And that was when he and members of his entourage were pepper sprayed. Then he went to the hospital to be treated. I asked him to talk about the claims that he was having delays and cancellations on the tour and what the problem was with the lighting. And he said, when you're a perfectionist and like to put 100% in the show and you put a million and a half on the stage, you want your million and a half worth. R. Kelly was adamant that he would be back at the garden the next night and wanted to finish the tour. With that, I thanked him for coming and he left. After the interview, my phone was on fire. Everybody was listening. I had such a high from being the person to deliver this moment in the middle of the night on the radio. I felt like I asked all the right questions. And for the first time in a long time, I felt like myself again. This is my shit. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what I do. I was excited. I was relieved. I was happy. When I got home, my son's father was sitting there in the living room. Were you listening? Did you hear? I asked him, super excited. It was crazy. Jay came to the station. Then R. Kelly came. He had the pepper spray in his eye. Yeah, you know what's crazy? He said. What? I asked as I noticed the sour expression on his face. I've never seen you so happy. You seem like you like being there more than you like being here, he said. I see you moping around and then I hear you on the radio and you sound so happy. So you're upset that I had a good work night? How could you not be happy along with me or even for me? I wondered aloud as a sinking feeling set in. Like, how could you be on the other side of this moment? I went to bed, numb again. My turning point began over dinner with Mary at Nobu. It wasn't a hit you over the head turning point revelation, but it was like she came up with the key to the locked place that had me so stuck. The last time I'd seen her was at the Garden about a month earlier, and I was so happy to catch up with her over spicy lobster salad, yellowtail sashimi with jalapeno, and a good bottle of wine. There was nothing profound in our conversation at first. "So how are things?" Mary asked. "Cool," I said. It was all I could muster. "Cool?" "Yeah." I was tired. Exhausted, actually. Both Tamir's father and sister were staying with us at the time, and his son Jordan, now 6, was off in there as well. Of course, I had taken on the responsibility that comes with caring for people in your home. Working, driving back and forth to Westwood every day, cooking, shopping, cleaning. By the time I did all this and checked in with everyone in the house, it was late, nearly midnight. And the next day would be the same thing all over again. Part of me liked it because I had never had a family structure like this, but a big part of me was still numb and just going through the motions. "How's your relationship?" How did she know? She knew me, that's how. "I don't really feel anything about it," I admitted. "That's not good," she said. Mary calls it as she sees it. "You can't be in a relationship and feel nothing. You're either going to be angry, you're going to be sad, or you're going to be happy. But you have to feel something." "I know. In theory, I know that, but I'm fine." I was just like dead. Flat. "Yo, you know that's not okay, right?" Mary was the first person to say that out loud to me. "It's not okay." Whenever you're making dramatic changes in your life, when it's a big deal, it happens in stages. First, you have to acknowledge that whatever is happening is not working. I was in that stage. This is not it. And then you have to acknowledge that you're going to do something about it. Well, I wasn't there yet. There were too many people that counted on me. But I was at least starting to articulate what I was feeling or not feeling. When I mentioned the conversation to Liani a few days later, she offered, "I know somebody that you should go see," suggesting a life coach in Manhattan. That's the thing about having good friends. They can help you get there. I knew I had to do something, I just didn't know what or how. Well, what did I have to lose? "I feel indifferent about everything," I told the life coach during our first session. "I don't feel bad, I don't feel good, I don't feel anything about anything, except my son, of course." She listened, and when I came back the second time, she shared her insight. "I was thinking about what you were saying the last time we met," she said. "I'm thinking, wow, I've never met somebody so indifferent about their life." Then I realized that you're not indifferent. You are so worried about how you making a change will affect other people that you are not being honest with yourself. Let me ask you this. Who is worried about you and your well-being? Why do you feel like it's not as important to worry about yourself as it is everybody else? Where do you put yourself in that equation? Holy shit. Sparks were going off in my head as I was taking in what she was saying. I know it sounds cliche. It sounds like something the almighty Mother Oprah would say. But that was the first time it resonated with me. And not only did it resonate, but it made me angry. Holy shit. Okay, so this person might fall apart if you leave them, she continues. You're worried about this one. You're worried about that one. Well, where are you on that list? Why do you not value yourself as much as you value everyone else? Is one of those other people valuing you on a level where you or your happiness is coming first? When she said that, it was like a light bulb went off. None of them are, I realized. None of them give a shit that I'm not happy here. They're just trying to hold on to me for dear life. Holy shit. Why do I not value myself enough to take care of myself the same way I did everyone else? The same care I give my child, the same care I give my man, the same care I give my career. I need to give myself the same amount of care. Everyone says, you've got to put yourself first. I'm happy enough if I can just put myself on the same level. I don't know why I hadn't seen that before. But it's like, God, once I got that, I saw how I was living. If you don't know that, you set yourself up for failure. You set yourself up to be less than happy, less than worthy, less than anything. And you're teaching everybody else how to treat you. It was my holy shit moment. Oprah has aha moments. I have holy shit moments. The floodgates opened and I started seeing everything. I could see how I was being treated. I could see that when I voiced that I was unhappy, it was more of a concern about me leaving than about my happiness. I could see. And that was it. I knew what I had to do. The idea was we were going to take a break, but I knew that I was never coming back. My son's father was out of town, so Nikki and I started packing up as much stuff as we could with just the two of us. Trying to fit all my shit into my convertible BMW and Nikki's Honda Accord, we realized we needed a truck. I called Pegas, but he said he was in a label meeting all day and could not leave. So we continued to box my things. My thoughts and emotions were erratic, all over the place. I don't want to be here when he gets back. Where am I going to go? How the hell is everything going to fit into my car? My anxiety level was off the charts. And just as I could feel myself cracking, I looked up and I saw Pekas' black Escalade driving down the cul-de-sac road. What? How did he get here so fast? What about his meetings? How did he know? I dropped the box and I just started crying. He hugged me and said, I'm here. I got you. What do you need me to do? That was him to a T. I got you. From a friend like him and from someone who was always in the trenches with me like Nikki was exactly what I needed to stop worrying. And so Pekas and Nikki packed me up out of that house. And then that was it. I got the fuck out of Westwood. For a brief and minor chapter that followed, I rebounded with a relationship that was exactly what I needed at the time. He was charming, he knew all the hot spots, and he brought me back outside again. He was driven like me and he championed my ambition. I knew what type of guy he was, but my intention from the beginning was just to have some much needed fun. The thing with dating a bad boy is that even though it's fun and sexy, they are not to be taken seriously. But for a quick moment, I forgot that rule and chose to ignore the signs. It started to get complicated and all my guy friends warned me that this was going to end badly. The person who really got through to me was Ebro. He was a radio programmer from the Bay Area who had just been promoted to program director at Hot 97 after Tracy Cloherty left Hot 97 for a TV gig. Ebro, a big guy with a deep voice and big scruffy beard, who could be intimidating and aggressive to some, had become one of my closest friends. He was a member of my extended family. We did poker nights on Sundays and spent holidays together, and he even used to take Nico to football games with the guys. We had this unique relationship because we shared the same commitment to the station, and he always was a great sounding board. I trusted him and his judgment and often confided in him. Every day I'd go into Ebro's office and we'd talk shit about the girl of the week he was seeing. He was charming and good looking, so he had his share. Although Ebro didn't want to break any guy code, I'm sure he knew a lot more than he was letting on about the guy I was seeing. He felt the need to say something. They ran in the same circles and probably dated some of the same girls. Through his discomfort, Ebro sat me down and went about it in his own way. Ebro shared a story about his childhood friend who wound up being with the wrong guy and having three kids with him. He was abusive and she wound up taking him back and got pregnant again. Then she found out he had a whole relationship with a whole other woman and another baby, so she divorced him. But at that point, she had already four kids. As Ebro's telling the story, I'm like, yeah, so what, dumb girl? Ange, Ebro said, cutting into my thoughts. I just want you to know she was super smart. You're probably thinking she's some bird who didn't know any better or whatever. She was ambitious and had shit going for her. She just made a bad choice in who her partner was. And now she's struggling. Her career's off track and she's taking care of those kids on her own. I just look at you and I would hate to see you make bad choices. It resonated. I beat myself up for a few months after that. How could I have gotten so far in with somebody I knew was incapable? It was my fault for lying to myself and his fault for lying to me. By the way, I know we've all been there, but I thought that normally happens in your 20s. This happened to me in my 30s, which is why I was so mad at myself. At least I was smart enough to jump off that fucking train. There was no warning. I stopped answering his calls. I just stopped. If there was a moral to the story, it's that friend by friend, who had my back, every single one who, like Pekas, told me in one way or another, I got you, set me on a path with